Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning. This is the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show coming to you live from the Gene Bosch Voice of Vachon broadcast studio in the heart of bustling and bodacious town of Vachon, Washington, located on the Isle of the Big Red Strawberry in the center of the Salish Sea. Easy for me to say that. Yeah. That was the voice of Brian Brown, who was our founder. Together, we, the Briefly, strive to keep Brian's brilliant flame alive by bringing you weekly episodes of intelligent, we hope, discussions of current events laced with humor and empathy, and always guided by Brian's mantra of less is more, more or less. Our Briefly panel includes our control board magician, former airline pilot, treetop landing aficionado, flight instructor, Vachon Airport Commissioner, West Texas devotee, and former, yes, it's not an oxymoron, military intelligence officer.
Well, that's actually military specialist, and I've been harassed
by some of my
buddies saying, you're an officer? I don't know.
Right,
no,
right.
I was not. I was an enlisted guy. But
you passed.
Yeah. Hey, I'm here anyway. There you are.
Good. And our legal beagle, arbitrator, mediator, Fulbright scholar, former constitutional law professor, and Washington State Assistant Attorney General, and Renaissance man, Craig Bellis.
Thank you, Bruce. I do appreciate you reading that intro that I wrote for you.
Yes, right. Yes, exactly. Well, you can pay me later.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, so.
You left off all around good guy.
I can't go quite that far.
Practical limitations.
There you go.
Today we're missing our part-time Politico director of Vachon Household, affordable housing advocate, and full-time shenanigans coordinator, Amy Dreher, who is apparently working with contractors on her shed, so takes precedence over the Brown Briefly.
We'll have to make up our own shenanigans.
Today.
Right.
Yeah, yes,
okay.
Right.
Okay. The gauntlet has been laid down.
That's right.
But next Friday, first Friday, there'll be time for shenanigans, right?
Oh, yeah.
So. And our indefatigable, if I can get that out, defender of democracy, mariner, backpacker, and most recently electric vehicle owner who strives to create a livable planet overseen by a government we can all appreciate or at least tolerate, Kevin Jones.
That's me. We're defending away every day.
And we need it now more than ever. And I am historian Bruce Hallman. Today, we also welcome our small talk guest. Both of our guests are renowned whale researchers who worked for NOAA and the National Marine Fisheries Service, among other many things. But Yulia Ivanchenko, who is a Vachon artist and whale researcher.
So yes.
Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting us.
Good to have you here. And Phil Clapham, one of the world's leading experts on large whales.
Good morning. Good morning, Vachon. And again, thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's good to have you guys here. So before we cover the news of the day, it's our usual lighthearted but seriously fashionable way. Let's check in with Briefly's and see how the week has gone. So, Truman, what was your week like?
Oh, I got a couple of things. I have a friend who owns a light aircraft out at the airport, and he had a little incident where he had a problem with the nose gear folding up on the thing, and was not the best thing to have. He was going very, very slowly. It just landed. So anyway, we've been working on this airplane for the last 3 days.
Propellers don't like it.
Propellers get bent when they hit the dirt. Yeah. And anyway, a bunch of other little things. But the most fun thing was I went to the Vachon Opera on Friday night. And I have to tell you, Falstaff was absolutely fantastic. I mean, the orchestra, the singers, it was hilariously funny. The orchestra was amazing. The singers were just fantastic. We had them here last week, wasn't it last week? 2 weeks
ago. Couple weeks ago
we had them on three of the principals and the director, and delightful people. And I think, Craig, you might be able to fill us in a bit more on that.
I will when my turn is up.
Okay.
Yulia, what has your week been like?
Oh, I have to think, because the first thing that comes to my everyday routine is dog walking, and then some gardening, and tidying up the house after the dogs and us. So this way it just flies by, and once the weather is nice, I just find any excuse to be outside, and we have a pretty nice big yard, so you can find many reasons to be there.
And I assume your garden is exploding like everybody else's right now.
It's beautiful. I love when it's blooming. And I never was a gardener. Oh. Like if you told me 20 years or even 10 years ago that I will be crawling around every day digging and planting and watering, I would just shake my head and say, no, not possible. But I learned that. Never say never. I do it exactly that.
Well, thanks. So, Craig, what's your week been like?
My week has been, in fact, eventful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
For a change, I didn't have to look at my calendar to remind me what I had done over the last week. I had two really wonderful things that I was able to participate in. One was at the Coop. On Saturday, the Dylan Fest that Steve Amston always does on Dylan's birthday, which is also Steve Amston's birthday, which is also Chris O'Brien, the great pianist and motorcyclist and MD. It's his birthday, too. So I was able to, we had close to 30 performances in the afternoon in the big outdoor venue there. And I got to get up and do my thing as well. So it was a wonderful opportunity to participate in the good times. The other event was something that Truman lassoed me into. I think the opera individuals, particularly Allison, the artistic director, she asked Truman whether or not he could find somebody who would... be the troll. They wanted the troll in the opera in the final scenes. And you may have seen the costume that fella had here at Halloween a couple of years ago, camped out in the middle of the road, which is a remarkable wood.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
He had to be rolled out because he had more of it on than I had on. Truman volunteered me to do that.
I'm going to pay for it in the long run, I'm sure.
Actually not. I had a wonderful time. It took me a little while. The headgear, the big mask, you know, I don't know, weighs about 30 pounds. And then you're kind of locked in this other thing with the big wood gloves and the feet, you know, weigh a ton each. But I had a fascinating and wonderful time. Got to know the company quite well, and just loved it. So I was very happy for that opportunity.
I have one major disappointment in your performance.
What's that?
And that is when everyone was taking their bows, you weren't able to take off your
headdress. No, I was not able to take a bow. The only thing I was able to do was to take that big finger that the troll has and point it at the audience and take my other big gloved hand and put it up in the air. Oh, by the way, I kind of got the supreme compliment from some of the major players in the opera. They said we loved your performance. We particularly loved your facial expression.
your face for radio paid off.
Obviously, there were no expressions going on there, but it was a good time.
Behind the mask.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like an exciting experience for sure. And now are you an opera devotee?
I've always been an opera devotee. Good. Yeah, right. I like the opera. Right. Matter of fact, there are many operas that I'm such a softy. They will bring tears to my eyes just listening to the music without seeing the actual play. So
Phil, what's your week been like?
My week has been pretty much what you would expect for a 69-year-old man going to the chiropractor, avoiding the gym. And otherwise, a lot of reading, a lot of cooking. I love to cook. And otherwise, just basically doing whatever my wife tells me to support her gardening habit.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's true.
Okay, great.
She does all the planting, and I construct things when I'm told to.
Yeah, fantastic.
And great. Feed me with a lot of good food in between.
Sounds like a great relationship. Kevin, how about you?
Oh, yeah, I did some gardening, too, at our place. It's more like what branches came down over the winter and do they need to be hauled away and which ones are big enough to be firewood. And hopefully the trees that they landed on that are the plantings, like from the land trust, survived. So I had one near miss, but as I unburied the Gary Oak, it was a survivor. So that's always good news. The ivy is now gone, all that I could find, so... It's a sort of a continuous thing. A lot of preparation, though, like preparing the boat. So filters and fluids in Opus 5 are all changed out, so we're ready to go. And on the more entertaining side, Francois has his Sunday rides. I finally was able to join those, so 2.5 hours on the bike on Sunday, up and down. We went up Gold Beach Road, which, that's about... sort of maximal aerobic exercise.
I would need a tow truck to get up that hill.
There was a very kind driver behind me not wanting to pass on the corner at the top where it's the steepest and I'm going the slowest. I really appreciate that. And also rowing 3 days in a row in a single, so I stayed dry the whole time. So that's a sign of success, but there's always so much more to learn in rowing. But it's a fascinating week last week and a great day this morning.
So, question, you have a Gary Oak on your property?
Well, they're about a foot and a half tall. We bought five of them from the Land Trust, and we had a bonus because one of them was intertwined with two smaller ones.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so we actually came away with seven. We lost one, and so now we still have six survivors.
Oh, interesting. Right. Yeah, it was interesting. Kids, Gary Oaks don't naturally occur here. Their range sort of stops down about where Fort Lewis is. And so most of the older Gary Oaks on the island, 200, 300, 400-year-olds, were probably cultivated by native people as a carbohydrate source in their diet. Okay. So you don't find them up here very often. So when I hear Gary Oak, my ears sort of perk up. Yeah.
Well, I'm curious, too, because I think that I've spotted a number of them in the San Juans.
Yes. Yep. So, and again, all apparently, I mean, some of them may have been, birds dropping acorns, that kind of stuff. But mostly, whenever they did occur, they were cultivated by native people and maintained and sort of sustained, because the diet here is very rich in protein, but not much carbohydrate. Mm-hmm. So bracken ferns, the sort of little Wapato potato, and Gary Oaks give them sources of carbohydrates.
Something to go with the salmon.
Yep, exactly.
And the venison.
I don't know about you, Bruce, but the diet here on Vashon is pretty heavy on carbohydrates.
So. It is now. It wasn't then.
I have to say that I'm happy when I go by, do the trails on different islands up there in the San Juans and see these thriving Gary Oaks, that if they can survive in that environment, I'm sure they're going to weather the summertime here quite well. At least that's my hope.
Yeah. But it's not part of their natural habitat range, so that's what's fascinating about them. So
yeah, interesting.
Anytime somebody says Gary Oak, I'm sort of like, okay, I want to know more. So my week... sort of typical getting ready, lots of gardening. I'm not the gardener. My wife is the gardener, sort of like you guys here. So I do what she tells me to do, but also getting the boat ready for the summer. And then on Sunday, went to just a magnificent ceremony, rededication of the Bacchus Garden behind the Senior Center. Senior Center was originally the library on Vashon, this memorial library built in 1945. And then Gus August Bacchus, the father whose two sons were killed in World War II, just 3 months apart, built the memorial garden behind it and has two plaques recognizing his sons, Tom and Lad Bacchus, who were killed in, both in air crashes in World War II. And so it the garden had been sort of abandoned and not very well cared for up until just a couple years ago. And then the Senior Center decided, let's restore it. And with help from the county and from the Beardsley Foundation, they just did a magnificent restoration of it. And so there was a rededication of that on Sunday. And then, of course, Memorial Day at the ceremony on Monday. So a meaningful weekend. And it feels like summer has finally arrived, I think. Or at least we can hope.
At least for now.
At least for now, right.
And tomorrow with the 80-some degree temperatures and the minus 4-foot low tide, you can explore all kinds of beaches in sunny, warm weather.
There is. And for those interested, there has been an elephant seal, which are pretty unusual.
Yeah. It's a northern, Molly, my daughter was telling me about that. Yep. A northern elephant seal.
Yeah, it's been on the beach at Ellisport, not the KVIN, but down near where the Tramp Harbor. End of it. And those guys are, I mean, they're 4,000 pounds. They're big animals.
Don't go out and pet them.
No. So, but they photographed it the last 2 days, and Bianca Perla from the Vashon Nature Center thinks it's probably molting. Phil, do you know a bit about elephant seals?
I know a little bit about it. I'm not a pinniped guy, but one of the things about elephant seals is they were, as were many marine mammals, hunted remorselessly. And they got down to a really small population around the turn of the century. That's the turn of the 20th century. And in, I forget which year it was, sometime early in the 20th century, the Smithsonian sent out an expedition to inspect all the known breeding sites for northern elephant seals in Northern California and elsewhere. And they found four animals.
Wow.
And as was typical in those days in that museum culture, they, quote, collected them.
Oh, right.
And amazingly, they've come back astonishingly well now. The problem is that they all genetically look very similar to each other, so they're pretty vulnerable to, you know, anything, any illness raging through the population, but they've come back remarkably well.
Interesting. Hmm. Yeah. So I guess that if you drive by Ellisport, you know, look out, particularly at low tides, he sort of drags himself up on the beach and sits there. And I think because he's molting, he's losing fur and skin. And I think, you know, prefers the warm beach to the cold water. So, but interesting. So, but keep your distance. I think the Marine Mammal Act, you need to say at least 100 meters away from a beached marine mammal. Is that
correct?
Yeah,
I don't know what the actual regulation is on that, but it's yes, but do not approach anything that's 4,000 pounds and has teeth.
Good advice.
Good general rule.
Particularly if you look hungry, right?
Yeah.
Well, today is May 27th. It's a good day like every day. But today, on a national level, is Nothing to Fear Day. It's inspired by FDR's March 4th, 1933 speech, in which he declared, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." And along with Nothing to Fear Day, of course, it's National Sunscreen Day, which is something to fear. So,
well, and more so now, we just saw a report here, I think it was yesterday, that they've concluded about 75% of all sunscreens are worthless.
Really?
Yeah. So one needs to pick their sunscreen very carefully now. I don't know what the key ingredient is. Oh, I'm sure it'll stop the UV light, but it'll cause you cancer.
Anyway.
Right, yeah, right. Nothing like the old zinc that we used to put on our noses when we were lifeguards, you know, sort of. It does work. Doesn't look good, but it does work. So today in history, just a couple brief things. 1905, the Battle of Tsushima. Japan decisively defeated Russia. Only 10 of the 45 Russian warships survived that battle. But it was the beginning of the rise of the Japanese Empire, and ultimately, of course, led to World War II and the United States and a change in relationships. Also in 1907, Rachel Carson was born, the author of Silent Spring. 1937, the Golden Gate Bridge opened, which was a boon for Puget Sound ferries because we got five of the ferries that used to run across the Golden Gate all came up to Puget Sound and became the basis of the steel electric ferries that were the heart of the Washington State ferry system through the 50s and 60s, well into the 90s. Washington State ferries have never known for keeping their fleets current, to say the least. And Amy, I'm sure, could comment on that. And then in 1941, the German battleship Bismarck was sunk by British forces. So let's turn to our small talk guests. And let me start with you, Yulia. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, about how you came to be a member of the Vashon Mori Island community.
Oh, for me, the story starts quite a way because I was born and grew up in Russia and middle part of Russia. So like I would refer to Moscow as my starting point, but my hometown is about 200 miles northeast of Moscow, which on our scale, we consider it's right nearby. And so I had very happy childhood, decided that I will be a dolphin scientist when I was still a little kid and pretty much strived to fulfill that decision through my
despite
days.
Being in a landlocked city miles from the ocean.
Yeah, I was as far as possible from any sea waters. So, but nevertheless, and it was like I pretty much was the joke of all the kids in the school when they heard this ideas of me being a marine biologist. But funny, I did that. So, and I worked after finishing university, I worked in the Russian Far East with Western gray whales, one of the very small populations. And because it was Russian-American team, I had chance to actually start to learn some English and come to some conferences and workshops where met with Phil, and my goal was to learn more of methods and projects and see the world, and he helped me with coming first and doing part, learning more about joining different projects here in U.S., and gradually I migrated to U.S. by staying in his house for a month, which was 20 years ago. And they never left this house.
and the problem was that my dog, so Yulia is known on the island as the dog person, and other people's dogs tend to become her dogs if she spends enough time around them because she's so nice to them. And my dog started sleeping with her on the second night. So we just decided it was easier for the dog if we got together.
Yeah.
So my migration was from Yaroslavl, which is my hometown. Then I lived in Far East and Petropavlovsk and worked on Sakhalin Island for a few years. And then I came to U.S. and I started with a very nice place in Seattle, which was like, for me, was a perfect world because it reminded me of home enough, but it was nicer and milder climate and very green. And from there on, we just kind of discovered Vashon.
Friends of ours, Lola Michelin and her husband, who runs the Northwest School of Animal Massage on the north of the island, they moved over here about 15 years ago, and we came over to see them and took one look at the island and went, oh, this is nice. So we bought a house over here in 2017, and then the following year we sold our Seattle house for a stupid amount of money, paid off both mortgages, and at that point I said, I think I'm retiring, and I did the following year.
Great. Yeah, so we came to a lovely paradise of Vashon, and like, it feels harder and harder to leave it every day. At first, I didn't believe that it will happen, but it's a reality. You don't want to leave it.
So you're also part of the Swiftwater Gallery. So tell us a little bit about your artistic life on the island.
On the art life, it's actually was good side of the pandemic when we were all sitting home, and I gradually, through the means of internet and YouTube, discovered what felting is and decided to take it on. And it's very old, basic technique of mixing sheep's wool with water and some soap and creating some traction or vibration that it forms a material called felt. And you can do pretty much anything you want out of that. So once I discovered, and it's like the practical side in me being a biologist, because it's very ecologically friendly material and natural material and could be easily degradable. So it just kicked into me like part that I like clothes and I like it to be fun and personal. And this way I can make my own art that they can wear. Or use around the house. So that's how it started. And I met a lot of wonderful artists on Vashon and became part of the Swiftwater Gallery, which is big part of, for me, is meeting the artist and being part of the community there. It's great fun.
It is a wonderful arts community here, for sure. Kevin?
As a matter of fact, we may have crossed paths there. There was a postcard writing event, and I think you came by and said hello and so on.
Okay. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so, I think I recall you talking about the work you did, the artwork that you did. But so you've both described, you know, how you discovered Vashon. But Phil, we haven't heard much from you about, you know, about yourself and where you started. And obviously, travels to Russia must have been part of that future or part of the past.
Short version, I'm English originally, came over here in 1980. There was a woman involved, as there often is. I came over for what was supposed to be 6 weeks, and that was 45 years ago now. Was actually, had done a degree in the University of London, traveled around the States for about 6 months because I had a bit of money, ended up on Cape Cod, and one day, like 4 days after I'd arrived in Provincetown, Massachusetts, was standing on a beach and I saw a whale jump, and I said, you know, what on earth is that? And someone said, oh, there's this little organization in the west end of town called the Center for Coastal Studies that studies them. And so I went down, knocked on the door and said, hello, you don't know me, but I have a science degree and here for the winter, can support myself. And that somehow evolved into a career in whale biology. So if somebody had said, you know, in the late 1970s, you will be an authority on whales, I would have just laughed and fallen over. But that's, you know, that's how life turns out sometimes. So I did that, went back, did a PhD, worked in various places on various whales around the world. And for the last 21 years before I retired, I was directing the cetacean program at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center in Seattle for NOAA. Wow. And so, yeah, so that's the very short version.
Wow. I find it fascinating, actually.
We could go into the whole issue of funding of NOAA, but we may save that. Yulia, getting back to your career, it's my understanding that you've been recognized for your revelations about illegal whaling in Japan and the former USSR. Can you tell us how much of that have you been engaged in, and how's it affected you?
Absolutely. And let me give you kind of the background for that story and my work. Because in 1946, number of whaling nations, including the Soviet Union, they had a meeting where they wrote the convention on whaling. And most of these countries, including the USSR, signed it, which, and part of this convention was rules and regulations meant to support and make whaling more sustainable. But starting in 1948, the Soviet Union, because it was such an isolated country with no much connection to other ships and the industries, they started to whale illegally, which means they pretty much killed the whales that were technically protected. And as a part of the convention, they had to report their catches yearly to the International Whaling Commission. And Soviet Union reported catches, but they reported falsified records. Oh. So they report part of the true catches, but then all the illegal catches they somehow hide or eliminate. So as a result, for over 50 years, this information was unknown. And in 1993, when Alexei Yablokov actually stood up at the international conference and revealed the truth that Soviet Union collected this large campaign, and it was thousands of whales that were killed, and people never knew.
It's actually 178,000 that went unreported, wow, according to Yulia's best estimates.
Wow. Just by the Soviet Union. And the part for whaling biology and managing the populations and understanding the situation, you need to know the true catches and true records so you will be able to go back in time and reconstruct what was the situation before whaling started, or at least at some point. And there was work started quite before me by a number of former Soviet scientists that was led by Bob Brunel, and to reconstruct these catches, because it was a few whaling ships that worked in the Antarctic region, and was a very high catches there on the impact that people suspected for years, but nobody could say anything or prove anything because the Soviet Union was a very closed system. And all the true information was kept secret. And all the scientists and people who were involved in the process, they were signing up the papers of not saying anything publicly ever. And the thing that changed during the perestroika, the whaling industry was, Soviet whaling industry was gone by that time, and these documents were declassified. So they were more of the public access. So that information, so I didn't start the whole process, but for the records for the North Pacific whaling, where was also a number of fleets worked through many years, this true catches was still very incomplete, and my goal was trying, we were didn't know how much of the records existed still, because after this information started to come out, some of the labs and offices, they burned the official reports. The good thing about the Soviet bureaucracy that they usually did multiple copies of each report, which I discovered later, and in the process of trying just simply talk to individual scientists or people who worked on board of these factory ships while they're still alive and maybe get some details of that way, I went to Vladivostok, and while talking to a number of scientists, one of them mentioned there is all this old whaling reports sitting in the public archive. So, and recommended me to go and look at that, and I went in the archive. It's like, oh my God, there is like pages of titles of different reports. None of them were important to, for my work, because my point was to reconstruct what was the catches of whales by species and preferably location. But there was technical reports, production reports, communist reports, financial reports. So I tried to get some copies of that. It was a whole story of working in the archives, because I'm Russian, which is helping. Like, I could read the Russian language and communicate with people. But at the same time, I just, like, I lived in the U.S. long enough, and even when I was in Russia, I like to smile. I like to be happy, and it's, like, was causing some concerns on the part of the archival workers.
Russians tend not to smile, and so the archivists were very like, are you Russian? Like, yes, I'm Russian. You're really Russian? It's like, yeah, I'm really Russian. I said, you smile too much. Just don't smile.
Oh, you're suspect if you smile.
And I should also add here that some of the records from the Antarctic were preserved because of really the courage of a number of former Soviet biologists who they kept them, even though it was illegal for them to keep them technically. During all those years of the Cold War. And, you know, for example, our late friend Dmitry Tormasov, who worked on one of the factory ships, he preserved 72,000 catch records that otherwise would probably have been destroyed, kept them in his potato cellar hidden for 30 years in Kaliningrad until the end of the Cold War. And because of him, we have this complete catch record for one of the Antarctic fleets. So really a remarkable individual.
Yeah, and it's a priceless set of information that he understood how valuable it was. So he didn't destroy it as he was required to do. And because for many other fleets, we don't have that many details. You kind of have bits and pieces because it's a summary report. So I read, like, I had piles of this report stuck. So I will read through them, and there will be some description of work and catches that I would reconstruct into the full numbers. Okay. And as a part of this work, I kept reading the description of Soviet whalers who worked hard. There was like a specific system that pushed them to get this very high catches and do catches illegally and violate the rules. And then between that, I was reading some of the summaries of Japanese catches because I was compiling them for different species, because in the North Pacific, it was only Soviet and Japanese fleets that worked pelagically. Mm-hmm. And the surprise for me was, like, while we knew details that Soviets, like, they reported this number officially, it was completely different picture. And then I'm looking at Japanese reports who were reporting, they're working in the same area pretty much in the same time. And somehow Japanese manages to catch something very different from Soviet whalers. How is it possible? Even if they're maybe better to some degree about picking some animals, but
were the records more accurate, the Japanese records, do you think?
No.
And we, by that point, it was already known that Japanese were doing illegal catches and falsifying their records on the shore-based stations.
Right.
But there was no information coming from them about pelagic fleets.
Mm. And we never thought we'd get that because they weren't about to volunteer it. But Yulia realized that if she compared the true Soviet catches with what the Japanese were taking, she could demonstrate that they were whaling illegally on a very large scale.
So, right.
Interesting.
So, because I just end up comparing things and saying, look at this data. I can't say what the final number, but it doesn't fit the logic that you're saying, complete truth. And that was the point.
Well, I have a really stupid question.
No.
But I have to ask. I understand in ancient times or in old times, why they were whaling and what they were using the whales for. But what are the products that are produced from current whaling or the more modern whaling?
Primarily meat.
But for whom?
For the Japanese market, by and large. So whaling is at a much lower level today. So it's really Japan and Norway who are whaling. They're whaling on a pretty modest scale for the most part, or the Japanese are making noises about going back to the Antarctic, where they haven't been for a number of years. So, you know, whaling is the reason that most whales were driven close to extinction.
Right.
But many of those populations have come back remarkably well in recent decades. And whaling really is relatively insignificant today. The bigger threats to large whales and other cetaceans are entanglement and fishing gear, which is a huge problem. And then there are other issues like, for some large whales, ship collisions.
Right.
North Atlantic right whales, for example, unfortunately, their habitats pretty much overlap major fishing areas and major shipping lanes. Mm-hmm. And that population has been kept down and is probably declining because of those two sources of mortality. And worldwide, I mean, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of cetaceans, especially smaller ones like dolphins and porpoises, are killed by entanglement of fishing gear.
Well, and also it's a byproduct or a bycatch, I understand.
Correct, yeah.
So I have to tell you that I have friends who are Inuit. I made friends with the Inuit in up in what was formerly known as Barrow in Bowerville. And I have had whale meat, and I can tell you, I don't understand how anybody can, why they would ever want to catch and consume whale
meat.
You
might have had the wrong kind of whale meat.
This is bowhead whale.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, I've had bowhead too.
Yeah.
Out of that hunt, in fact.
Right.
And that hunt has been going on for probably thousands of years.
Yes, of course.
It's a very well-managed hunt.
Right.
The population is growing at about 3.5% a year. We won't get into the whole, you know, what's going to happen to bowhead whales in the Arctic and climate change, but right now, at least, that population's doing very well. And I've never had a problem with that hunt. I mean, it's truly subsistence.
And they're using umiaks, and they're using harpoons, hand harpoons.
Well,
in some cases they do have a gun.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. And I'd rather they do it in a more humane way. But it's kind of a typical of how the West deals with indigenous peoples, because it wasn't the Inuit that wiped out bowheads. You know, it was primarily American, French, and British whalers.
Sure.
And then when they were done and they were commercially extinct, then you sort of turn around to the locals and say, you know, oh, you're bad, you're killing whales.
Yeah.
And so I've never had a problem with that hunt. It's done in a very responsible way.
I thought so too. I was actually able to go out onto the pack ice and visit the whaling camp and see the equipment and things that they used. Fascinating, fascinating to me. So what's the future hold?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Right now, as I said, there are a lot of whale populations that have bounced back really well from whaling. So, for example, humpback whales in the Southern Hemisphere, if you take the populations that migrate up past Australia and New Zealand, those were hit really heavily by whaling, particularly by the Soviet catches. Just to give you an example, in the two Antarctic seasons of 59-60, 60-61, the Soviets reported officially they'd taken 2,700 humpbacks.
Wow.
The true total was 26,000.
Oh my gosh. They took
that in two seasons. And that killed the fishery because there were coastal whaling stations in Australia, which had been doing perfectly well up until then, and then suddenly they crashed and they closed because there were no more whales. We don't know what that population got down to. It was probably under 1,000. But now there are tens of thousands of whales in that population. Humpbacks are really, really resilient. There are a few populations of whales that are not doing well. North Pacific right whales are probably the most tragic example, again, wiped out by Soviet whalers in the 60s. There may be only 30 or 40 whales in the eastern North Pacific population of the right whale.
Wow.
But, you know, what happens going forwards, if you leave whales alone, I think they will continue to do well unless climate change introduces some major issues. And, you know, the biggest one of those is probably what's been called climate change's evil twin, which is ocean acidification. Because that's essentially irreversible and could basically knock out the bottom of the entire food chain, in which case whales and human fisheries and everything else is going to be in major, major trouble.
Exact. Yeah.
So that does lead to a next question having to do with scientific research funding. And right, we've all heard in the news about the current administration's passion for cutting funding for all sorts of scientific endeavors. What does it mean for the whales? Does it compound the challenge? And maybe is there something you've seen in the past that may be lessons for us to apply today?
I don't think we've seen anything in the past like this administration. They seem to actually be proud. This is a bunch of people who seem to be proud of being ignorant. And even though they use science in pretty much every waking moment of their lives in various ways, their contempt for science is just remarkable. And what this administration's doing is going to create sometimes, I think, irreversible damage on the progress of scientific research, not just in whale research, because whales are way down the list of priorities compared to things like human health and disease. I don't know what the future holds. I just hope we can get through at least the next couple of years until the midterms and hope that the Democrats get their act together and do some blocking on this.
Well, you already mentioned, Yulia, that you came to the United States, and and part of that was bringing your knowledge and experience here. And I understand people are now deciding to go to other countries as a consequence, Phil, of what you just said. It's quite concerning.
Yeah, there are very few places to run to, because I was usually, when I came here, I was very happy, because every time I get upset about things happening here, I would look back of what was in Russia, and now it's not as optimistic here too, but the time goes up and down, like historically, if you will say, look, it's just, yeah, we tend to do things back and forth, but it just means that short term is probably not very good proposition to be inspiring scientist or somebody trying to work with the nature.
Phil, you're a fairly prolific writer, I understand. You have numerous publications, 4 books, over 100 peer-reviewed papers. Are you continuing to write? And if you are, what are you writing now?
Well, most of my writing these days actually is writing odd little bits for the Beachcomber, which I enjoy thoroughly, because, I write a books column for the Beachcomber. In fact, I just interviewed Bruce to ask him which books he would take to a desert island. And that one will show up in the Beachcomber at some point in the next few weeks. I wrote a novel, comic romance novel, which, isn't ever going to make me rich, but it was a lot of fun to write. Mm-hmm. And I still am involved a little bit. I've got one remaining PhD student, still a co-author on a number of papers out there. But by and large, I'm not really doing a hell of a lot of science. Enjoying sitting around and actually reading an awful lot. It's one of the great things about retirement. You can just pick up a book and sit in your yard and read.
I haven't figured out how to do that. Yulia, you also are a writer. You have 34 or so peer-reviewed articles, and you're an artist. As you mentioned before, you're a member of Swiftwater Gallery. Tell us a little bit about your writing and your art. And while you're at it, the two of you have been rather active in the Vashon Film Festival and Institute, too. You might even talk about that a little bit.
I'll cover my part of writing and working. It's since my research was very specific to a topic of Soviet whaling, once Russia started the war with Ukraine, it's pretty much stopped any of my attempts to go back to Russia, because I still believe that you can find more details and information, but more or less on a large scale, the question I was working on, it's mostly covered. And you can always refine things and learn into some more, but with the pandemic, Phil retiring, I definitely stepped back a lot from doing a lot of research, because I was always independent contractor and was trying to find my own funding, and now it's getting less and less and less possible. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to share the data. I give it to some scientists when they ask about that. But I'm not doing a lot of new research. I can cover maybe some and revisit some of the details, but I'm so happily busy with belting and dogs and social life on Vashon because, yeah, I love movies. It just, it's a whole world that I can be spending days in.
Yeah, so. my involvement with the film festival started 3 years ago when Mark Sayre, who runs it, who's a good friend of ours, just emailed me 2 days before the film festival and said, "Congratulations, you're the photographer for the film festival." Because the guy he hired just suddenly said, "Nah, I'm not going to do that." So I've been the photographer for the last couple, and I probably will be this year as well. And that's been just great fun because you get to hang out with cool people, and in addition to all the usual film festival stuff that you do, I take a portrait setup and I'll grab actors and directors and put them up against the background and say, "I need 5 minutes of your time and I want to do some portraits." And I've done some really fun portraits of them, some of which have been used in their bios, which has been really, really flattering. So, yeah, it's been fun. And it's a great film festival. It's just so much fun. And Mark has done so much to revitalize the theater here.
Your photography is remarkable. It's wonderful. It was mine and my wife's pleasure meeting you. I think it was 3 years ago at a dinner that Mark put on at his father's house. And quite a dinner it was.
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, yeah, that was an amazing dinner. He's an amazing cook as well.
Yeah.
So just quickly, when is the film festival this year?
It's the middle of August. I forget the dates exactly.
I think it's a little earlier this year. I think it starts like on August 7th or 8th.
Yeah,
or
it might be the 8th. But okay. Yeah, Mark is, I assume, on his way back from the Cannes Film Festival. And I'm sure that a lot of his work is going to be consumed now with organizing the film festival on Vashon.
Great. So with the current administration and all the cuts that are being done in research and all that we've already talked about, what's the future of whale research? I mean, is there any
further work that can be done? I mean, there's a lot of federal money in whale research. It's why people want to come and work here, because there has been much more funding in whale research in the U.S. than there is anywhere else in the world, including Europe. And things have changed. I mean, long before this administration, things changed quite a bit. There used to be major champions for marine mammal research and marine mammal protection in the United States Congress. I mean, back in the 70s and 80s, there were people like Gary Studs who were, they pushed through the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act, both of them signed by Nixon, by the way, along with a bunch of other things. But then gradually those people sort of disappeared, and there have been no real champions for marine mammal research. And now, of course, you've got an administration that's just beholden to whoever is making money out of things that are harming marine mammals. And they've just, the last week, they just issued a thing about gold standard science. We're returning to gold standard science, which basically means you're going to just ignore all the science. So, I don't know. It's not a rosy future at this point, I'm afraid.
Well, let me ask a question that's sort of been intriguing with me. Is, Yulia, a lot of your research was based on sort of what I would call sort of antagonistic deep state employees who held on to data that they weren't supposed to hang on to. Do you see that happening here? Do you see people, fail you too? Do you see people continuing to do research under the radar of the administration and keeping that alive?
I think it's a little early to see what's happening in that regard. My former research group at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center, a number of people have been either fired or have seen the writing on the wall and have retired. Mm-hmm. I think we'll see down the road I can tell you that people who work in marine mammal research they're not doing it for the money, believe me. They're doing it for the love of it and for the love of the work, and also because many or most of them believe strongly in conservation and doing what they can to preserve these populations. So they'll keep on doing this stuff, and they'll keep on trying to find ways to, you know, make things work. I mean, we've had it really, really good in the U.S. for a lot of years relative to other places. If you go to some of the developing countries where friends of mine work, they don't get paid. They scrape together enough money to run field projects that are sometimes of considerable importance to conservation. So I think it's going to be a bit more like that here and then in the near future. But they'll find a way to keep the work going.
So really appreciate your insights and commentary on this really important, obviously southern resident orca is a really iconic issue, you know, for islanders and people in the Pacific Northwest. But in addition to maybe keeping up, Phil, with your writing in the Beachcomber, Yuli, your work at Swiftwater, how maybe other ideas of people so can just sort of stay in touch with what you're doing?
Well, my email address usually gets printed in the Beachcomber, and people are very welcome to contact me. I love to hear from people, especially about books. You can go along and see Yulia. She works a number of shifts at the volunteer shifts at the Swiftwater, so they can come along and see her there.
Yeah, we're both very social, and we are always happy to talk to people as long if you have any questions, because you don't have to know everything. You just should feel free to ask questions.
And if you are walking on the street with a dog, then we will come to you.
So we recently had a whale wash up. Did you folks have anything to do with that, or Phil? Or
a little bit. So I've talked with the Vashon Nature Center about that, and I guess they're hoping to have that exhibited at VCA by April next year.
Wow.
And I said I will be, they asked me if I would do a talk on big whales to go with that. So I'm, of course, happy to do that.
And it's quite a big project to put together a whole skeleton of a whale and clean it.
Yeah. So, and I assume then that, that you've had a chance to work with the good doctor on his work. I'm just going blank on his name. I know the man very well, but give me a minute.
Tag
Grinnell.
Tag,
yes, Grinnell. Thank you.
Yeah. No, I've never actually worked with Tag, but and I'd never met him actually until I came to Vashon. But we ran into each other one day, and I said, "Oh yeah, well, we have a lot of dead people in common because we're both old and we've been around the field forever." Yeah. So yeah, he's a friend and great guy.
No, I'm just curious, and we used to have a talking series called Telling Stories, and Tag did one of our telling stories. Fascinating. I would love to have you folks do one for, maybe we can reinstate it with KVSH as a fundraiser. We'll have to pursue that a bit.
Oh, there are plenty of stories from the whale business.
That's what I kind of thought.
Yeah. One bit of Tag Grinnell trivia is he actually named Smalltalk. Yes, I crossed paths with him in front of the post office some years ago. It's the second most popular place to cross paths with people on Vashon and Thriftway or the IGA. And we mentioned that we were going to be having guests on and, talk a little bit about what they were doing. And he says, "Oh, small talk." So that's how we are. Thank you, Tag.
Perfect.
So we're down to the last couple minutes. Kevin, can you give us some updates on what Indivisible Vashon is up to and what's happening
over the next few weeks? Absolutely. Keep your eyes peeled if you are at downtown Vashon for First Friday, June 6th, because the Indivisible Vashon folks will be meandering through the streets. You may see the Drum Corps. I'm not exactly sure when their debut will be. Could be on the 6th. They're practicing now. So be around for that. Also, June 14th, there's a correction to what I mentioned at the last week's show about the start time. But on June 14th, No King's Day, get together at the four-way stop. Pretty certain the Drum Corps will be there. They're going to start at Ober Park at 1:45. instead of 11:45. So 1:45, keep that in your mind. And so from 2 to 4 or so, you know, at the four-way stop. And then Strawberry Festival. It looks like we will definitely have people in the parade. So, you know, if you want to be part of all of this, if you are not already receiving our newsletters, you can go to indivisiblevashon.org and you'll be able to, you know, keep up with what's going on in this resisting activities.
And just for clarification, the film festival is August 7th through the 10th this year. There you go.
All right. So, Kevin, you're up next week. For briefly, what do we have coming?
It's the, as we like to call it, a Truman Show. So we do not have a small talk guest next week. So we are free ranging. We'll see what kind of chaos happens over the next 7 days. And be sure to tune in next week to hear about it.
I'm sure it'll be chaotic, that's for sure. All right. Thank you for Yulia, Phil, Amy, who is not here, Truman, Kevin, Craig, I'm Bruce. We thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.